Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the broadcast. Thank you so much for tuning in once again. I'm Neil Stavem. Ryan Nisley at the controls.
Hello.
Grace Reif there is taking care of phones, and we're looking forward to spend some time with a friend who's a musician, a performing artist, a writer, and is a Bible student and a Bible study. Well, I guess we could call him a scholar. I don't know if he likes that that title, but we're looking forward to spending some time with Michael Card today. I understand, Ryan, that you. Michael Card played an important part in your adolescence, is that right?
He played a huge part in me growing up to be the person that I am, and he can hear me right now, so we'll see how he reacts to this. But basically, he had this great album, instrumental album, from Revelation, and it was incredible, and just epic, stirring, orchestral. And I would play that on my computer, the first computer we ever had, and we were in Montana, you know, at the time. Yeah. And so computers were significant in eastern Montana. And I would play that while I was playing a computer game where you would colonize the world. And so that really made me the person I am today. So, Michael, thank you for that.
You're welcome. Am I on?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. It probably would have been better. It probably would have been better if we just kind of waited till now to put you on. But yes. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, the main thing I need to know what kind of person you become today. I mean, if I'm getting blamed for it.
Well, that's this is a very good point. Yeah,
he's waiting to claim it until he finds out.
Exactly. Well, right.
Well, I'll attest to him. He's a fine young man, and we love. Working together here on the show, and really appreciate you coming on with us again, Michael. I know that you're going to be up in the upper Midwest in the area coming up in May, and we'll talk a little bit about that, a Biblical Imagination Conference, so excited about that. In fact, you've spent a fair amount of time working on that series on the Gospels, those commentaries from the Biblical Imagination series, and what the latest one coming out here in just a couple months, right?
Right. I just finished Matthew. The book comes out, and we're actually today we're working on the Matthew record. In fact, I'm all the guys that I'm recording with are in the pizza place. I'm sitting in the parking lot. I can see them sitting eating pizza. Oh, so if I sound kind of slobbery when I talk.
We are going to be talking about sacrifice today, so this is going to work out well, I think. So we.
Well, that's just me. That's me all over, Neil.
Humility 101, I think, was where we learned it. Anyway, we want to talk about actually a new release that has come out from InterVarsity Press called "A Violent Grace: Meeting Christ at the Cross," and it represents just a number of short little chapters. I'm thinking it's the 20 or so chapters that really help us focus on this week and the crucifixion, and it's a wonderful, it could be used as a devotional or just to help us kind of review the story again. Michael, I've appreciated a lot, and I'm looking forward to talking about it today.
Well, thanks. We're moving quickly towards Easter, so this is a good time to be talking about the Passion Week.
It's called "A Violent Grace." In fact, as you mentioned, you're recording for Matthew, but you recently came off of tour, right? A Violent Grace tour. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's right. I don't know how many cities we did. We did about a dozen cities, and we present. Starting with the triumphal entry, we go all the way through the Passion Week, and talk about the. Talk about engaging with that story with your imagination, because there's so much wonderful detail in the gospel that allows you to do that. You can actually be there, I think, in your imagination in a pretty significant way.
The song "Violent Grace" that we just played, just a little bit clip of it now before we get into our discussion as we talk about some of the events of that last week.
Okay.
Upon him, scorning all the shame, but all for love he died and overcame. So ruthless he loved.
Violent Grace is the title of a new little book from Michael Card. The subtitle is Meeting Christ at the Cross. And Michael, I guess one of the things that comes out clearly in this presentation is that this event was filled with violence. And, you know, it's sort of a contrast, I guess, to use the word violence and grace together. But I think we have sort of sanitized Holy Week and the crucifixion, I think, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. We've made a sort of an empty symbol. I mean, symbols are good, but we've emptied the cross of that, of the full range of the, of its meaning. And it was, you know, an incredibly violent moment. I think even Mel Gibson who was trying to push the envelope, didn't even portray how horrific an experience it was.
The reality of the suffering Savior, I guess as I was reading this again even last night, just reminded us that when Jesus was, I mean, when it says he was bruised and, you know, by his stripes were healed, I mean, he literally was beaten.
Well, he survived the flogging that a lot of people didn't survive. The flogging itself was enough to kill some people. Augustus had one of his wives flogged in a Roman flogging, and she lost an eye. It was something that frequently disemboweled people. And again, I don't want to just focus on the physical, because far more horrific was the emotional and the spiritual experience of Jesus on the cross. But even the physical, I think, even when we try to portray it accurately, we don't go far enough.
You know, you talk about in the beginning of the book that you know, the cross has lost some of its significance. I mean, it's a symbol of Christianity, but it doesn't show up prominently so much in preaching or music or even art anymore. Talk about maybe how, was there a point in your life where you said, I need to refocus on the cross?
Yeah, I think there was. Early on in my ministry, I focused on the scandal of the gospel and the cross, really to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, that verse in Paul, I'm determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. That was really my theme verse for years on the road. And there came a time when the record companies and even some guys in the band, you know, they would say, you know, when are you going to stop this? You know, enough is enough. And so eventually I think I settled, you know, on some other themes that were less, you know, maybe less difficult to deal with. And so when I wrote this book, I think part of that was trying to get back to that original focus on the cross.
Is it because it's so hard? It's so arresting? It's so maybe confusing? Why do we shy away from it?
Well, you know, I think there are lots of reasons. I mean, the early Christians shied away from it. They didn't depict Jesus on the cross until 420. Our first depiction of Jesus on the cross doesn't come until 387 years after the event. So for them, of course, the problem was there. It meant too much. And for us, it doesn't mean enough for them, because those early Christians were obviously still seeing people crucified. And that was an image that maybe was too violent for them. But I think for us, we've emptied it of its meaning. For a lot of people, you know, in the rock and rollers, the secular rock and roll community, you know, cross is just kind of a fashion. You know, everybody wears crosses, and it doesn't, you know, it does, obviously then it doesn't mean anything. But you know, I think for me, I was just bowing to pressure. People were complaining and wanting to hear, you know, different themes, and so I was happy to oblige.
You know, it's interesting in the speaking of the cross, that it was maybe too familiar to you know, first century Christians. Certainly, you pull a lot of Old Testament passages out in this book, and there's been a lot more, it seems like, attention, focus on Old Testament, how the Old Testament points to Jesus. And interesting, I didn't realize that the Old Testament talks more about crucifixion than the gospel accounts. So talk a little bit about that.
Right. Well, there's a more detailed account of the crucifixion, much more detailed in the Old Testament than the New. In the Gospels, all you have is basically, and there they crucified him. There's no account of nails in his hands and feet. That doesn't come until after the resurrection when he points the scars in his hands and feet. But, you know, they pierced my hands and feet. That's in the Psalms. So, you know, Psalms 22, Psalm 13, Psalm 69. And some passages in Isaiah speak, of the emotional experience of being abandoned and all that Jesus suffered. That you just don't, you simply don't find that in the New Testament. And I find that fascinating. Certainly, is a great, that alone is a great reason for reading our Old Testament.
In a few minutes, we'll talk a little bit about Gethsemane and about betrayal and some of those things, and go back to focusing a bit on Psalm 22 and other Old Testament passages. But one of the songs that you've written is called "Come to the Table," and just talk a little bit about that that upper room time with the disciples and what Jesus, you know, what he really wanted to communicate there, and you know, did the disciples really understand what was going on?
Well, he had been talking to me way back in John 6. He says, he talks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. So this was not a new idea. And even then, in John, God tells us that he lost a lot of his disciples at that point. They said, you know, who, this is a hard saying, who can accept it, that sort of thing. And so, you know, this is, you know, probably two years later, the Lord's Supper happens. And I'm not so sure the disciples, you know, still didn't really understand. I don't think they really got it until after the resurrection. Actually, Matthew tells us that even after the resurrection, some of the disciples still doubted. So that persistence of doubt, is a big, big theme in the Gospels. But when Jesus is redefining, his whole ministry is about fulfilling and redefining the Old Testament. And so he takes that Passover meal, which, of course, is a celebration of in Exodus in the wilderness when the angel passed over the houses that had the blood of the Lamb on their doorposts. Jesus redefines all that. Of course, he's the Lamb, and it's his blood that, as it were, is going to be applied to the doorposts of our hearts, of our lives. And the disciples, I think he's spoken of being crucified. He begins the meal by saying, "One of you is going to betray me," which I think is enough to spoil any party. So I picture the disciples during the Passion Week as being very confused. I think Peter basically has a nervous breakdown. I think when he's the third time when he's asked, you know, about Jesus, and he says, "I don't know him." I'm thinking that Peter basically suffered a nervous breakdown.
And to get some more perspective on this story that is familiar, but we want to just continue to mine some more truth out of it here in our time together, talking with Michael Card, and we're talking about his book, A Violent Grace. It's Meeting Christ at the Cross. It's 21 short chapters that take us back to this important week in our church history, and we'll talk more with Michael in just a moment. I invite you to stay tuned.
Come to the table and taste of the glory and savor the sorrow. He's dying tomorrow. The hand that is breaking the bread soon will be broken. Fled into the wilderness, you fled to be alone, and you grieved the world's cruelty, you knew in flesh and bone the heartache of mistreated and the sorrow of alone. Lord, you walked in lonely places. Oh, you felt our emptiness. Lord, you walked in lonely places to know the pain of man.
That's something fairly new from Michael Card, our guest today. It's from his Biblical Imagination series from the Gospel of Mark. And it's called Walked in Lonely Places. In fact, Michael and his team are recording the music to accompany Matthew today. Or at least your team is eating while you're talking to me, right?
Yes, but I'm not bitter. I would much rather talk to you, Neil, about this.
Sure.
That's actually true. I mean, the sad thing about me is I'd rather talk about the Bible than eat.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We're glad to have you. We'll both be fulfilled then here by the end of the hour,
yes.
I think. So that'll be great. you know, that song talking about walking in lonely places, I appreciate your reflections on the Garden of Gethsemane, and I guess I'd forgotten about what the name Gethsemane means, but talk about Jesus in the garden.
Yeah. Well, Gethsemane, it's not really a garden. In Jesus' day, it's almost like an industrial, Gethsemane means place of crushing, but it is a large complex in Jesus' day where they manufacture olive oil, which is, used, you rub it on your face, you cook your food with it, you put it in your lanterns. I mean, olive oil was a very important, you know, part of the economy. But there still are olive trees there. And I think Jesus moves into the shelter of those trees, originally to rest, but he doesn't get much of a chance to rest. He goes in there and, leaves what seven or eight of his disciples. He leaves at the gate to be watchmen, and they're miserable watchmen because they don't alert him that the soldiers are coming. And then he has the three go farther in with him, Peter, James, and John. He tells them, "I'm so sorrowful. I'm about to die. It's about to kill me." The crush of knowing exactly what is about to happen to him. I mean, he's been telling them for the last at least two or three weeks as they're walking from Galilee to Jerusalem for that final time. He's told them in increasing detail he's going to be bound, he's going to be spat upon, he's going to be crucified, and on the third day raised again. And they never heard that. I think when he said, "Be crucified," they all stopped listening.
The name of the location, the place of crushing, that sort of took on new meaning, I guess, as I was reading just some commentary about it.
Definitely, because he is being crushed. I mean, there would have been no Calvary if there hadn't been a Gethsemane where Jesus goes. And I don't think there's any other way to read this. He goes to the Father and says, "If there's any way out, I want out." You know, we sort of think sometimes of Jesus as this concrete plaster saint who walked 3 inches off the ground, but he's very, you know, in every bit, in every way, he's human, as we are human, only without sin. And so that temptation to say no to God's will, what else can it mean when he says, "Not what I want, but what you want"? Even now, and I've thought about this for years, even now it's hard to say that. It's hard to imagine Jesus struggling with the will of his Father.
Well, and just to, as you approach it, I mean, that it is sort of the ultimate final temptation. I mean, that,
yes,
you know, somehow I guess, you know, we don't think of it as temptation. Well, that, you know, yes, we understand that, you know, Jesus was tempted in every way as we are, yet was without sin. But somehow we just don't think of this, I guess, as a temptation.
Sort of a theological construct, but not, we don't think of the reality of someone sweating blood because they are so tempted.
The pain of it all, and then, you know, as we talk a little bit about his disciples not being very good watchmen, Peter, James, and John asleep, and then Judas and the soldiers come. I mean, that would have been just insult to injury, I guess, the beginning of many insults.
Yeah, and an insult, by the way, that was prophesied in the Psalms. You know, my own familiar friend is lifted up his heel against me, the one that I'd shared fellowship with, and that is Judas. Judas, who I think, again, I'm guessing, I think there is a very good chance that Judas might have been one of Jesus' closest friends. The reason I think that is that at the Last Supper, Judas is sitting on Jesus' left hand, which is traditionally the place of the intimate friend. And Judas was given, the very important responsibility of taking care of the money. And, I'm just speculating here, but I think I think he may have been very close to Jesus. Not this person who lurked in the shadows the way we picture him, but a person who, after they came back from their mission and they were all rejoicing together in Mark, you know, that even the demons submitted to them. I think Judas was one of those people that was celebrating.
Which we can hardly comprehend how, you know, Jesus, knowing what was in men's hearts, would continue to sort of carry on fellowship with Judas for these years, and knowing that there was a point coming when, you know, his life was in his hands.
Yeah, and I think John tells us that. He knew from the very beginning who would betray him, you know. And, I can't imagine dealing with that. And I have no doubt whatsoever, though, that Jesus reached out till the very last minute. Well, he does in the last meal. He reaches out to Judas, you know, to the end. But we also have to realize that the deck wasn't stacked. Judas could have not betrayed him, because his free will was still operating, but he obviously did.
And the kiss of betrayal, and Jesus called him friend still.
Yeah, and that kiss, I think, was a normal greeting. I think that the idea of the kiss is we're not going to do anything that's going to tip him off, right? So I'm going to greet him the way I normally greet him. And he calls him rabbi and gives him a kiss. And but that was the sign. And then something interesting in John, the Gospel of John, the interesting thing is the priests fall down and the soldiers fall back when Jesus says, I am he. You know, they were, first of all, they were expecting a search. They had lanterns and torches, even though it's full moon. Passover, it's Passover when the moon's full. But they're expecting a search. But then lo and behold, the person they're expecting the search under the bushes for walks up and says, who are you looking for? It's me. And when he says this manifestation, I am, the idea is that he manifested the divine name of God, and God's name is I am. The priests hear that name that's not supposed to be spoken, and they fall down. The soldiers, who couldn't care less about the divine name, think it's an ambush, and they fall back in military way. But the odd thing is, Jesus is talking to this company of men who are all on the ground, and he asks them again, "Who are you looking for?" And they, cower and say, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he says, "Let these men go. You've got me."
We're going to talk more with Mike Hart about A Violent Grace, Meeting Christ at the Cross. One of the Michael's great songs is called Why, and here before we go into break, we'll hear a little bit of that. Think about the traitor's kiss and all that transpired in this this week as we review it, and we'll talk more with Michael Carr in just a moment.
The seers and the prophets have foretold it long ago that the long-awaited one would make man stumble. They were looking for a king to conquer and to kill. Who'd have ever thought he'd be so meek and humble? He will be the truth that will offend them one another. Why did it have to be a friend who chose to betray the Lord? And why did he use a kiss to show them that's not what a kiss is for?
Only a friend can betray a friend. A stranger has nothing to gain. And only a friend comes close enough to ever cause so much pain.
Why did there have to be a thorny crown pressed upon his head? It should have been a royal one made of jewels and gold instead.
It had to be a crown.
The crown was there to wipe away the tears that burned the holy eyes of God. As he looked upon his one and only son, who'd never sinned nor lied, yet was crucified. The marks of death that God chose never to erase, the wounds of love's eternal blood.
Think about that. We'll recognize Jesus in one of the ways, certainly by the scars. Michael Carr's with us today, by the way. Michael's an award-winning musician, performing artist, songwriter, and also has a great love for God's Word. In fact, has studied and become a Bible scholar and has written several books. In fact, a series from InterVarsity Press called the Biblical Imagination Series, which provide commentaries on the Gospels. And the new one from Matthew is coming out here shortly, in a month or so. We'll talk about that. Well, the one we're referencing today is a short little, maybe you call it a devotional book or a reflections called A Violent Grace, Meeting Christ at the Cross. And it's just simply short chapters that reflect on what Christ accomplished in the cross and why that's so important for us. And Michael, I think about that old Fanny Crosby hymn, you know, we'll know him by the print of the nails in his hands. And talk about why. Right. Why would God not give Jesus a new body without scars?
Well, I think it's one of those upside down things about the kingdom, that his wounds are really, I think, a glory to him. But he was always wounded. He was the lamb that was slain from the foundations of the world. So Zechariah, for example, has a vision of Jesus, and the first thing he asks is, "Where did you get those wounds?" And Jesus, in this vision, responds, "This is where I was wounded for my friends." And John, in the Revelation, when Jesus comes back, he's weeping because no one can open the scroll, and one of the elders from my church, jabs him and says, "Stop crying." He said, behold the lion of the tribe of Judah. So John looks up expecting to see a lion, but he sees a lamb, and he knows who that lamb is because it's wounded. So I think Jesus has always, in this sense, been recognized by his woundedness. And I think the application is that we aren't to be known by our degrees or by our awards or whatever. We're to be known by the scars that we've incurred from faithfully following him. I think scars are a glory to us too, actually.
You know, you talk about the lion and the lamb. That's just one of the many aspects of paradox about God's ultimate plan and purpose in sending Christ to the cross. I mean, it's yeah, just sort of completely upside down.
It really is. I mean, how does he win? He wins by giving up, right? How does he give us life? He gives us life by dying. He sets us free by being bound. I mean, some of these are, more prosaic than, cold hard facts, but I still think they have meaning. But it really is, Paul says Jesus is crucified in weakness. And that was the whole idea behind the song El Shaddai. You know, your most awesome work was done through the frailty of your son. I think that's a powerful idea.
You talk about, in fact, the chapters in the book refer to some paradoxes, and I'll just read through some and just kind of let people sort of reflect on them a bit. He was born to die so I could be born to new life. Mm-hmm. He suffered temptation so I can experience victory. He was betrayed so that I might know his faithfulness. He was arrested and bound so I could be rescued from bondage. He stood trial alone so I might have an advocate. He was wounded so I could be healed, and so on it goes. I mean, just I'm wondering if in our pragmatic minds, if we just have sort of a hard time with paradox.
Well, I think we do. I mean, I think certain of us do. You know, some of us are head people and some of us are heart people, and there are rare people who, are both. That's one of the things we're trying to do in this Biblical Imagination Conference, is get people to listen to the Bible with all their hearts and all their minds, the way, Deuteronomy 6, says we should love God by listening to him with everything we are. But I think paradoxes are hard. But I also think there's an odd way in the human mind in the sense that paradoxes represent the only way that really big, I mean, infinitely big truth can be communicated, because it's simply too big a truth to be reduced to some theological proposition or certainly any book that anybody could write. And so I think, yeah, it's all upside down. There's a moment in the Gospel of Luke that is one of my favorite moments. There's not anything like it in Jesus' life anywhere else. Luke says that Jesus was full of joy through the Holy Spirit. It's the only time that's said of him. Jesus, full of joy through the Holy Spirit, says, "I praise you, Father, that you've hidden these things from the wise and you've revealed them to little children." So something about this is exciting to Jesus, that Jesus' Father is the kind of person who would turn the world upside down this way.
You know, speaking of joy, there's that pretty challenging verse in Hebrews 12, right? Talks about, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross.
Yes.
I mean, how can we even look on this week and say where could there possibly be joy in this devastating week?
Yeah, that at this absolute low point in not just in Jesus' life, but in anyone in humanity, you know, the one time in all eternity he separated from the Father. And that becomes an occasion for joy but here's the part I think we can understand. He experiences joy because he realizes what this is going to accomplish, that his death and his suffering is going to make it possible for everyone to know God. I mean, he dies for the sins of the whole world.
On the cross, he quotes from Psalm 22. And I've heard the statement before too that an Old Testament understanding of scriptures, they were well versed, so that even just saying one portion of the verse, they would recognize the whole passage.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about Jesus' words on the cross and how that would have impacted those standing around watching.
Well, there's an old idea that says he actually quoted the whole psalm, and I don't think that's a good idea, because what you have on the seven last words of Jesus, what you have are short, gasping phrases, because what you realize is, you have to realize he has to push up on the nail in his feet in order to get a breath, and then he has only a few seconds to say whatever he's going to say before, in exhaustion, he falls back down on the nails that are in his hands. So nobody's quoting entire passages of the Psalms. So, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is the first verse of that Psalm is all he says. You know, I'm thirsty. He says, son, behold your mother, mother, behold your son, that sort of thing. They're all short, gasping phrases, but I find it incredible that when Jesus is looking for a way to express his lament, he does what you and I should do, and that is he goes to the Psalms. I mean, he finds in the words of that Psalm 22 the perfect words to express the grief and he's being separated from his Father. And notice that he stops calling him Father at this point, and it's only my God. So I think that even that speaks of the separation that he's feeling.
You know, as you've done the Biblical Imagination series, you've tried to focus maybe more so than we have in the past, as we've read the scriptures rather maybe dryly. Talk about the emotional state or, I guess, experience of not only Jesus during this time, but maybe even his followers as well.
Well, I mean, I can definitely, I don't know if I can begin to grasp his emotional state, but I know his followers, and I stress this, you need, on Good Friday, we need to realize that for Jesus' followers, it's over. I mean, it has all been for nothing. They have left their homes and their families for nothing. It is absolutely all over. In fact, I wrote a song called "This Is All Over Now," because when you're standing before that cross and you see him die, it's been for nothing. And the significant thing, and I think this is huge, Neil, Easter Sunday morning, no one is waiting outside the tomb. The women come to anoint a dead body. I mean, they're going to care for a corpse. That's why they've come. Even when they see the stones rolled away, they think someone has stolen the body. And when they see him, they don't recognize him, because I don't think they, in their wildest dreams, they expected to see him. Mary thinks he's the gardener. You know, the disciples on the road to Emmaus talk to him and have no idea who it is. And then, you know, weeks later, the disciple in Matthew tells us they're standing on that mountain in Galilee, and even Matthew says, and some of them doubted. I mean, they're standing there with him, and some doubted. So persistence of doubt, I think, is a big theme. But, the emotional state of his followers it's done. This has all been for nothing. You know, Jesus lost. But they don't understand. He wins by losing.
Yeah. Back to the paradox again.
So. Yes. Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit more about that and touch on the new biblical imagination study in Matthew, which is coming out, and plus also the Biblical Imagination Conference, which will be along in a few minutes. I should say, I guess, in a few weeks. That's probably better. We'll talk more with Michael Card in a few minutes. Let's do that instead and play a little bit of El Shaddai right now here on Connecting Faith with Michael Card, talking about a violent grace.
El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Elyona Adonai. Age to age, you're still the same by the power of the name. El Shaddai, El Shaddai, Erakim Kana Adonai. We will praise and lift you high, El Shaddai. Through your love and through the ram, you save the son of Abraham, and by the power of your hand, turn the sea into dry land. And to the outcast on her knees, you were the God who really sees. And by your might, you set your children free. El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Yonah Adonai. Age to age, you're still the same by the power of the name. El Shaddai, El Shaddai, Erakim Kana Adonai.
Of what you'd come to give, to drink for us that crimson cup, so we might really live. At last the time to love and die, the dark appointed day, that one forsaken moment when your father turned his face away. Love crucified arose, the one who lived and died for me. Satan's nail-pierced casualty, now he's breathing once again. The crucified arose, and the grave became a place of hope. For the heart that sin and sorrow broke is beating once again.
Wonderful music from Michael Card. He's my guest today. Michael's been recording albums for a number of years, 20 plus, and in fact, working on their next one today, and he's kind enough to take out a little time to talk with me here as we talk about A Violent Grace, Meeting Christ at the Cross. It's a book that is written from Michael here recently and available from University Press, and it would be a wonderful Holy Week review, and not just for now, but to stay with it for weeks to come as we consider again the cross and what Christ has done for us. Michael has also written a series of commentaries in the Biblical Imagination series, and the new one on Matthew is coming out in a moment. And Michael, let's talk a little bit about Matthew and the other gospel writers. I mean, much of the gospels, there is a good deal of the last week of Jesus' life. That takes up a lot of time in the gospels. So talk about their attention to detail.
Yeah, a third of the Gospels are on the last week of Jesus' life, so that lets you know how important, you know, the Passion Week is. And they've all got different accounts. Matthew, I think, has more detail. Luke has an awful lot of detail. Mark is not so interested in the detail. John is interested in things no one else is interested in. John is 92% unique, so he's interested in the fact that none of his bones are broken. He's very interested in the aspect of the fulfillment of the Jesus is the Passover lamb, you know, because when the Passover lamb was sacrificed, none of its bones were broken. So John's interested in that. But all of them, I think, struggled to put it into words. I mean, how can you reduce something like this to words?
And yet they were careful to put in, I guess, even little details, right, about the you know, whether it's the women coming to the tomb or just even sort of naming the tomb, and just all sorts of things that if we're looking for historical reliability, there is plenty to be found there.
Oh, the way they line up is really, miraculous. That four different people writing, you know, in four different times. Two of them aren't even eyewitnesses. They're talking to eyewitnesses, but the fact that all of that eyewitness testimony and then the personal testimony lines up, I think the accuracy is really unbelievable.
In your study of Matthew, did anything maybe stand out? You've done Luke and Mark. What impressed you or intrigued you about Matthew's account?
Well, the thing that I had never seen before in Matthew, Matthew is interested in the fact that from the very beginning, people were trying to take his life. I mean, only Matthew tells us about the slaughter of the innocents, right? And all through the Gospel of Matthew, it's presented that there are plots to take his life all along. And right up to the cross, Matthew tells us that on his way to the cross, Jesus is offered wine mixed with gall. Now, when the other Gospels refer to this incident, I think Mark refers to it as myrrh. We know that myrrh is a narcotic, but the difference between the Aramaic word for gall and myrrh is only one letter, so they're very close. And they're two completely different substances. Gall is poison. And so I think what Matthew wants us to understand is that on the way to the cross, I think Satan tried to poison Jesus. He does not want him going to that cross, right? And I think that's one of the uniquenesses of Matthew's portrayal, is from the very beginning, Satan is trying to take his life. That storm on the Sea of Galilee, I think, was another, you know, attempt that we can all think of where he was trying to drown it in the temptation in the wilderness, trying to get him to fling himself off the temple was an attempt, you know, again, to kill him. And then again and again, their plots, the Pharisees and different people, his own village in Nazareth, they tried to kill him as well. So I think that I'd never seen that before in Matthew.
It was just in looking over the gospel again, Matthew, Jesus said, you know, I didn't come to bring peace, and it certainly seems like there is an awful lot of contention in Matthew's gospel.
Yeah, you know, and he compares the ministry of John the Baptist, where John had said, you know, he's come to bring fathers back to their sons, and you know, this idea of bringing people together. When they asked Jesus, a father against a son, mother against a daughter, father-in-law against, you know, I mean, he completely portrays his ministry as dividing families, which I think was very important to Matthew's first listening audience, who were Jews in the synagogue, who were being kicked out of the synagogue because they followed Jesus. I mean, that literally, you know, literally is true. Families are being divided because of him.
And yet, you know, those that you would think would have been Jesus' closest friends or followers or admirers, you know, those that were most serious about their religious walk, seemed to get in the biggest, conflict with them.
Yeah, and that, I think that's Mark. Mark loves to portray that in chapter 3. The two groups that Jesus might have expected the most support from, his family and the religious leaders, there in Mark, you know, his family, they're determined that Jesus is out of his mind. And in the very next verse, the religious leaders accuse Jesus of being demon possessed. So, and that goes right through the ministry. I mean, in John, Jesus' brothers mock him and make fun of him. And so there's an example of the different gospels portraying very accurately this conflict that Jesus had with his own family.
You know, we're talking about mocking. I know you have a chapter in the book Violent Grace about, you know, he endured mockery so I could know dignity and joy. And the fact is that there was so much of that. I guess we've again sort of sanitized the story and, you know, forgotten how painful it must have been.
Yes, and the Jews mock him in one way, and the Romans mock him in a completely different way. The Jews mock him by putting a blindfold on him and then beating him and saying, who hit you? which goes back to something that the rabbis have said. The rabbis have said that the Messiah, when he comes, is not going to judge by what he sees, that he's going to judge by what he smells. And so they actually are testing this. You know, obviously, they're not testing to see if he's the Messiah because they're going to crucify him. But that's a uniquely Jewish way to mock him. The Romans mock him by playing a game. They play a game with Jesus. There are 70 different board games that we know of from Roman times. They were big board game players, and one of the games was a game called King. And you would move your man across the chessboard or the game board. And at one point, if you got to a certain point, you would get a staff. At one point, you would get a robe. Then when you got all the way across the board, you would say King, just the way we crown people who move all the way across a checkerboard, right? If you get all the way across, you get crowned.
Yeah.
Well, the Roman soldiers were doing this with Jesus. At one point, he's their pawn. They're playing a game with him, and so they put a robe on him, and then they put a scepter in his hand, and then finally they crown him with thorns, which is a sick joke. That it seems that they're the only people that understood that joke. So he's mocked in a number of ways that I think are unique to the people that are mocking him, which again is an example of what you were talking about of the accuracy of these gospels.
Michael, you're coming to the Minneapolis St. Paul area here on May 3rd for Biblical Imagination Conference, and there'll also be a concert with that. Just say a word about what happens at a meeting, a gathering like that.
Well, I think we're still going to be working on the Gospel of Mark at that point. And so what we'll do is we'll have the whole day together to talk about how do you read a gospel in general, and specifically how do you read a gospel like Mark, what's unique about each one of the gospels, who is Mark, who is John, that sort of thing. And then we close the conference by asking people to engage with the text, what we in general, what we do, unless we find something more creative to do. What we ask people to do is engage with the story of Bartimaeus and write themselves into that story. And that's always a really powerful time when you imagine yourself standing before Jesus and Jesus saying, you know, what do you want me to do for you? The way he asked Bartimaeus.
Well, it's our hope here that during this, even this week, that we might all, maybe anew and afresh, come to that place and allow Jesus to ask that question in our lives, whatever that might mean. What do you want me to do for you?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I have yet to answer that question for myself. So I make everybody else answer, but I haven't been able to answer it yet.
Well, it's one worth reflecting on, as is the book Violent Grace, Meeting Christ at the Cross. I would recommend it to you. It's from University Press. Just a short little book, like 21 little chapters, but it will give you a new understanding of the sacrifice of the Lamb who's slain for the sins of the world. Michael, always good to visit with you. Blessings to you in this Holy Week, and we look forward to having you in the area here in a couple months.
Thanks, Neil. I'm looking forward to coming back.
Michael Carr joining us today, award-winning musician and writer, and been talking about the Biblical Imagination Conference. By the way, we've got links on our website, myfaithradio.com, and you can sign up for that today, myfaithradio.com. Thought we'd just wrap up with a little bit of one of my favorite early Michael Card songs called Carmen Christi.
In human likeness, found in appearance as man, he humbled himself, was obedient, even to death on a cross. At Jesus' name every knee shall bow, in heaven and in all the earth. Father's glory, each tongue cry, Jesus is Lord. Jesus' name every knee shall bow, in heaven and in all the earth. To the Father's glory, each tongue cry, Jesus is Lord.
Thanks for joining us here on Connecting Faith. You can listen to the podcast we put up online here shortly after the show. It's myfaithradio.com.